may listen to the meeting or make comments to the committee using the call-in number or Zoom webinar link. In the event there's a disruption of service which prevents the agency from broadcasting the meeting to members of the public using either the call-in option or internet-based service, this meeting will not be postponed or rescheduled, but will continue without remote participation. The remote participation option is being provided as a convenience to the public and is not required. Members of the public are welcome to attend the meeting in person. To participate in public comment from your computer, tablet, or smartphone, when I announce the agenda item you wish to speak on, click the raise hand feature in Zoom. You will be notified when it's your turn to speak. Please unmute when requested. To participate in public comment via phone, when I announce the agenda item you wish to speak on, dial *9 to raise your hand. Phone participants will be called on by the last two digits of their phone number or by name. When it's your turn to speak, dial *6 to unmute. I'd like to remind the public that's present today that there are public comment cards on the table outside. Please complete and return those to Ms. Kang to help expedite public comment process. The procedures for tonight's meeting are as follows. I will introduce each agenda item. Staff will present. I'll ask for public comments. I will then ask for discussion and questions from committee members. The committee then comes to a consensus to move an item to the board for consideration. Any PowerPoints shown at tonight's meeting will be posted to the SCD Water website. At this time, all committee members are present, and we'll start with item number one, Pledge of Allegiance. President Martin, would you please pledge me another
chair? Would you please put your hand over your heart? Follow me. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America. And to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you, President Mark. You may be seated. We'll move on to item number two, public comment. Are there any comments from public in attendance?
No.
Same? All right, move on to item number three. Recommend adopting a sustainability action plan, and that's going to be presented by Mr. Matt Dickens. Mr. Dickens? Please go ahead.
Yes. Hi, Chair Averhofsky. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Okay. I'm going to not share my camera because it seems to take my bandwidth. And also, I seem to come down with a viral infection. So I'll save you from the horrors of having to see me present. So let me share my screen. Can you see my screen okay?
Yes, we can.
Okay, well, thank you again, Chair Ozerhofsky and members of the committee. I'm Matt Dickens, Sustainability Manager, and I'm joined tonight by with Lauren Coller and Eric Feldman from Rincon Consultants, who we've been working on this plan for about almost 2 years now for the agency. In addition to the packets that the staff reports that we provided, I have a brief presentation to share for the committee's use and review. So the tonight's objectives will be to kind of look at the planning process overview, the plan components review, obtain committee comments, and then our main objective is to approve the sustainability plan for board consideration. We'll get to that. So with that, our agenda has an introduction. We'll look at kind of some time milestones and project team members. And we'll also look at climate sustainability plan components, the overview of the plan, benefits, energy and GHG inventory and forecasting, measures, recommendations. We'll conclude with next steps. And recommendation and the question and comments. So this plan has had a lot of folks working on it during the course of its development and its curation. That includes myself, Julia Groth, who's also a conservation, though she's now focusing on large landscape programs with some change up in our department, but also Ryan Gardner, and Erica Lennard, who couldn't be here tonight, but again, Lauren Coller and Eric Feldman are here. We've also had additional staff support. That's from sustainability, water resources, operations, engineering, administration, IT. We've had just a number of engagement meetings across the agency to try to build a plan that captures the strategic components embedded in our strategy plan, but also those that are, conform and comport to what the objectives of the plan are and that can be accomplished in collaboration with other groups throughout the agency. So here's kind of an overview milestones of what has been involved in sustainability beyond kind of things, the evolution of sustainability leading to the development of the plan. In 2019, we had the SCV Water Strategic Plan that did have mentioned specifically strategic components, and I think those are included in the staff report. In 2019, we had a collaboration with a USC public administration graduates who did a review of our opportunities as well as common smart practices in the industry. In 2019, we launched the Green Team, which incorporates staff from across the agency and meets quarterly. In 2020, sustainability staff conducted the internal initial analysis and kind of determined from that analysis that we really needed to bring Frank Kahn on board to help dive further and expand our scope and range of the analysis. So in 2021, we procured a contract with Rincon. In 2022, we had a lot of activity with Water Resources and Watershed Committee review early last year. We had a public workshop in July and then a board workshop following the public workshop. And then in 2022 and 2023, we had internal staff review, drafting of the plan, a public 30-day public comment period. And then here we are today to have Water Resources Watershed Committee review in consideration. And then perhaps based on those outcomes, Board of Director review in consideration. So about climate action planning, when we look at strategy plans or any types of plans, we like to look at mission, vision, values, and mandates. Mandates are kind of, looking to see what's kind of happening in the environment. And as you can see here, there's quite a bit of activity across the state to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, to increase electrification of operational devices, and then also to improve the source mix to clean renewable energy. With climate action planning has a role in water agencies' long-term planning. For us, that includes integrated regional water management, hazard mitigation planning, water supply reliability planning, and water conservation programs, which, by the way, is a core crucial component of our sustainability programs historically, but also moving forward. So the benefits of sustainability and climate action planning include grant funding. It improves our scoring for grant funding opportunities by having adopted a sustainability plan that will increase our opportunities increase our scoring when we apply for future grants. We can state that we have an adopted sustainability plan. It identifies energy efficiencies and savings potentials. It can future CEQA streamlining. This is a first step in developing a CEQA qualified GHG reduction plan for CEQA streamlining. And then we have enhanced sustainability of operations, such as the 2020 supporting, again, longstanding and historical sustainability action planning objectives and potential GHG reduction measures. So just to kind of go through the project schedule of how it works, in this plan, this was taken from a previous slide. So there's some notes in here that just are not still applicable, but I think the general sentiment is here, and that is that you kind of want to first take your baseline inventory of all of your uses Number two is kind of develop a forecast emissions. Three, adopt targets. Four, strategy selection. Five, funding and implementation. And then six, monitoring and tracking progress. And then I tend to think you probably want to keep the kind of a cycle of analysis so that you can adapt and implement measures optimally and most effectively. So the baseline inventory of our emissions, we have three types of scopes of emissions. Scope one is direct emissions from sources owned or controlled by SCVs, such as natural gas, propane, gasoline consumption. Scope two are emissions from power plants supplying electricity purchased by SCV for use at its facilities and offices. And scope three are indirect emissions occurring as a result of SCV operations, such as commuter vehicle trips and construction emissions. And so we did a inventory here to the right, table 3.2 from the sustainability plan. As you can see, it identifies those different types of scope emissions and their contribution to our total emission profile. Which should be noted, electricity by far is the number one contributor to emissions. So then we kind of look at, in the plan, a forecasting of energy consumption and GHG, subsequent GHG emission forecasting, considering business as usual. And as you can see here, we have a table that shows from 2025 through 2045 that business as usual, based off of our demand projections and agency operations kind of continuing as they are today, increasing from 24,000 metric tons of CO2 to 32,000 in 2045. This chart shows us that energy and GHG forecasting, if we look at it through our baseline, which is our 2020 baseline, that's the blue dotted line. Our business as usual forecast, what I just showed in that table, the green line, kind of you can see how it increases from today out to the 32,000 by 2045. Then we have our adjusted forecast, and that's considering the environmental scan that we conducted that showed that with the activities for clean renewable energy in the market that are planned in the state of California, much of these emissions, considering that electricity was our number one source of emissions, that with clean renewable energy in California, the purple line is the adjusted forecast. That's the GHG adjusted forecast that's going to occur by virtue of background noise or just by nature. And then with our targets, we can get to zero by 2045, as shown here. So our measures and recommendations, again, they come into three different scopes, scope one, scope two, scope three. Scope one had four measures, scope two had two measures, and scope three had four measures. Those are identified in the plan. We measured those, worked with staff, to develop those based off of, priorities, cost effectiveness. But really these co-benefits were critical pillars in determining the measures. That's reliable and resilient operations, high quality water and resource sustainability, those measures that are cost effective and efficient, and then those measures that can identify transparency or support transparency and accountability. So our next steps, here we are today to submit the plan for the SCV Water BOD for consideration and adoption based on the outcomes from the committee. We also would move on to developing implementation strategies, priorities, and cost-effectiveness protocols. I think it's important to note that while the plan does have an implementation schedule and identifies measures, what it doesn't do is it doesn't dive into the cost components that those measures will incur the agency, because it's saying here's the measures, and then leaves those decisions to management, the agency, and staff based off of optimal, market conditions, based off of capacity, based off of priorities, based off of strategic investments. So those things would be determined at the appropriate time in the implementation schedule. We would then procure consultant support for service provision based off of that strategy determination. And then we have the use of CapDash. This is great deliverable from the tool to report annually and to track progress of our GHG measure implementation. So with that, I will conclude with a staff recommendation, and that is for the SCV Water, staff recommends for the SCV Water, Water Resources and Watershed Committee to recommend the SCV Water Board of Directors consider adopting the sustainability plan at its meeting on Tuesday, July 18th, 2023. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions or comments the committee might have.
Thank you, Mr. Deakins. Before we open up this to committee, any public comments in attendance?
No. Will we have another attempt to
Please hold on. Can you talk to 3 minutes? You can just wait until the counter comes up. All right. Please provide your public comment.
Well, we have another time to see this, really what you're doing with this and what you attempt to accomplish by it. I haven't heard that in the meeting.
Well, the draft is available online, and I believe it's on page 30 of the draft, table 5-1. It gives you the reduction measures by scope.
Why are you doing it? I think most of the people will want to know, why are you doing it? Simply, just put it simple to them. And I don't see any attempt at that at all. And there always has to be a reason behind making a major change. And that should be put out there for the benefit of the ratepayers that will be deciding it in the long run.
This concludes your comment, question?
I think I'm out of time.
We still have a minute and 50 seconds.
Yeah. Well, if you understand what I'm asking for, because I've sat through all your meetings, as you know, and this comes up, and even what they're presenting isn't given to the public to read. If you had one, I would appreciate receiving one to see if there was any kind of paper given to you explaining what you're accomplishing by this. And all I see a lot of time spent on something and back and forth, and we never hear about it again. And I would just like something to show me what it is you're proposing. And would they really come out in force if they saw what you're doing? And I've seen this too many times, where the public gets caught in something like that. And I can never find one where they benefit from it. So that's all my questions right now. Thank you.
Actually, I couldn't agree with you more. You know, that all depends on what happens in Sacramento. Mr. Deakins, were you able to hear the public comment?
Yes, Chair Mr. Hospital, I was able to hear the public comment.
Can you just provide a brief statement of why are we doing it and who mandates us to do this?
Yes, absolutely. And I would state that, you know, again, the plan was released for public comment period April and May. We did receive 2 public comments back on the plan, but the objective of the plan is to improve the sustainability or to accomplish sustainability for specific components of our business and operational practices for the agencies. These mandates are coming down from Sacramento. Some of them are happening in different sectors, but will ultimately affect the agency. And so what we're trying to do is understand what that landscape, that changing landscape will incorporate and include, and then try to identify how to optimally and cost-effectively and efficiently incorporate those components into our service provision so that they improve the agency sustainability at the lowest, hopefully the lowest cost possible and burden on the ratepayer.
Thank you, Mr. Dickens. And also, I'd like to point out that this will enable us to apply for more state and federal grants.
That's correct.
Ms. King, are there any comments from public attending virtual?
There's none.
All right, I'll open up to the committee. Any questions, comments? President Martin?
Thank you, Chair Ozahosky. Matt, thank you for your presentation. I know you mentioned a few times that much of this effort is mandated by legislation from Sacramento. You've offered up in the fiscal considerations that it will enhance our ability for state and federal grants. Have we made a stab at trying to establish what the cost is to the agency to implement this plan? I do believe it's a worthy goal. Sustainability in general is a worthy goal. But I'm curious, and I guess we'll find out going along, what the cost is to the agency to move forward with this program.
Thank you, President Martin. Sorry. Thank you, President Martin. That's a very good question. And I'll provide a little bit of context, but also perhaps Eric with Rincon might be able to kind of comment on that as well. This plan incorporates, again, a number of components that the agency already is implementing. Like, for example, one of the biggest contributors exists currently to our sustainability efforts as they're identified in this plan are our water conservation programs. And we know that those have a cost, and we implement those in a cost-effective and efficient manner, although those costs change, and we analyze that, and then we implement that at the most optimal, effective manner possible when we are expressing those programs. This plan does not aim to identify those costs, because it would be fairly complicated to do, considering that some of the components are not currently available in the market and may become far more affordable. But then again, it comes down to when we get to the implementation schedule, our team with consultant support and management support would be looking for the most cost-effective way to implement these programs. But Eric, maybe you can provide some more context on that.
Yeah, most definitely. Thanks, Matt. I think you did a really good job characterizing it. But this is a long-term plan extending out to 2045. The technologies and costs will change, as will the efficiencies of the items that we're looking to invest into. Not to mention, the intent of the plan is to be strategic, to identify an outlay of investment at the right time and the right place, so that when you are making the investment, it's a replacement investment. It isn't the full upfront cost. What you're rather looking at is a marginal or that replacement cost. So if we were to just characterize a singular outflow at this time and place, it would provide an unrealistic representation of what that actual cost will be to the agency over time. So what we've done is we've approached it from a higher level, where we identify incremental actions that support each of the measures. And one of those actions for every measure is to do an analysis of the cost to implement that measure at that time, to get the best representation of that cost, so that a strategic outflow of that investment can be made with the best interest of the ratepayers and the agency.
Thank you. I appreciate the explanation. One more point before I, and this is kind of a just a typo thing. And I'm going to support this moving forward to the board, Matt, but if you compose a staff report that goes to the board, I would suggest that you not mention the Urban Water Management Plan twice in the same sentence, like you, on page 2 of the staff report.
Okay.
delete one of those. Not much, just a simple thing. But anyway, thank you. I will support this moving forward. Okay.
Fred Cooper.
Matt, as technology and things change, how often will we need to update this plan?
Director Cooper, thank you for the question. We believe the plan should probably be updated every 5 years.
So, very good. Good, thank you.
Any remarks, any questions?
Yeah. Let's see. Yes. This is working.
Oh, that one's pressed.
I don't dedicate that. I have for the presentation that helped a lot. On the presentation, you talked about the plan will help us to prepare a CEQA streamlined document. What is that? That some quick way to get through CEQA that has been provided by the legislature, or what? I was left questioning what that was.
Thank you, Director Marks, and I would forward that to Eric regarding the plan being a first step towards that more elaborate CEQA streamlining piece, but Eric can describe that.
Yeah, sure. I'm happy to. In the CEQA guidelines, there's a provision that allows for an agency to analyze greenhouse gas emissions programmatically. As Matt showed in as one of his slides, there was an analysis of the existing greenhouse gas emissions from the operations of your facilities. And then there was a forecast out into the future. As that forecast goes out, what we do is we try to develop effectively mitigation measures to reduce the emissions down to state levels, which is effectively carbon neutrality by 2045. When you have done that and you have provided all the substantial evidence and have a plan go through public review process, then you can use that plan in the future to state that any project in the future that is consistent with that plan, you would not have to analyze the greenhouse gases for it as part of your CEQA analysis because it was already included and mitigated in your plan. So this is the first stage. What we would need to do is add a little bit more rigor to some of the technical analysis in the analysis of the greenhouse gas reduction from each measure, go through a thorough public review process, and then we could certify this as a qualified greenhouse gas reduction plan, which would allow for that CEQA streamlining.
That's perfect into a programmatic EIR.
You would not have to do a programmatic EIR. You would just have to run through CEQA on it in whatever format you felt was most defensible. In my experience, it's usually a mitigated negative declaration.
Right, but I guess the streamlined CEQA sounds like it kind of is parallel to a programmatic EIR.
It operates the same as a programmatic EIR would, so projects included in that programmatic EIR would not have to go through CEQA anymore, just like projects included in, say, a greenhouse gas reduction plan would not have to go through CEQA analysis for the greenhouse gases.
Okay. Oh, thank you.
Sure.
Director Cooper.
A general comment about the plan. Atlantic acknowledges that most of the greenhouse reduction, or most of our greenhouse reduction is actually going to be associated with Southern California Edison having a new state mandates. I think it would be helpful to include some language in the plan that talks about what the current estimates of cost impacts are on that. You know, there's substantial investments in transmission facilities as well as source facilities. And while I acknowledge that it's not a direct cost, it is a direct cost actually. But what we will end up having to bear in this new regulatory environment. So I think it would be useful for the directors to at least have, at a minimum, a qualitative, not a quantitative, estimate of what those costs are going to be like. And presumably that could drive decisions that we may make with respect to providing our own solar and battery storage projects. And even if we acknowledge that we're going to make the final judgment for investments like that in the future, I would think the report could benefit from some additional information for the directors to consider. I had some comments on some specific information in the plan. And I did speak with Matt Dickens about this beforehand, but figure 1-1, which shows
which page?
It's page two of the plan itself. And page 6 in the PDF. I'm not sure that this figure is accurate, in that much of our source of supply comes from local wells, which we're getting our energy from Edison, so that's presumably part of the greenhouse gas emissions that are covered in this plan. Now, I agree that the imported source of supply, those are costs that we're paying through our state water project. State water project bills. Half of our source of supply is actually included in this plan. and then the demand management or conservation. That's, as Matt pointed out, part of the plan also. And the information in that bottom half of the document. And I'm not sure I think that it ends up being a little bit confusing. I mean, you have all these planning documents and they're mentioned in various parts. And there's really not enough text to kind of support or help the reader understand, in my view, why various items are under various columns. So I'd ask that before you present it to the board that you go back and look at revising that that document, that figure.
And just to note that, Director Marks, I did capture your comments from our discussion. Want to again share my appreciation for taking time to review that and provide that insight. We haven't had time to incorporate those comments into the document yet, but we will work on that between now and the board meeting should the committee approve the recommendation.
And another quick comment on figure 1-2. Interesting information, I think. The dip water deliveries in 2019 may serve to distract the reader. I think a more appropriate graphic might be to look at the longer term history and projections of water deliveries, as that supports higher greenhouse gas emissions for the business as usual aspect of the estimates made elsewhere. Matt spent a lot of time going over other aspects of the document, and I don't think we need to go over all of that with the committee. Unless there are some that you wanted to highlight or you think that you'll be making some changes that you feel that the committee ought to be aware of.
The Director Marks, again, thank you for sharing your insights. And our team will incorporate these changes into the plan and create an errata document to capture those for transparency purposes.
Thank you, Matt.
Thank you, Director Marks.
No, I answered my own questions. Thank you.
Mr. Dickens, if you can go back to your presentation where you show table 3-2, kind of analogous to table 5.1, but if you go back to table 3.2 and see if you can pull it up. Director Marks has identified that the biggest contributor to our emissions is our purchase of electricity from SoCal Edison.
Sure.
And it amounts to 84%. And we know that the utilities are being forced by Sacramento to change their sources of electricity to be, you know, carbon free by 2045, as you identified in the plan on page 18. and by 50% by 2030. So it is my understanding that we don't really have to do anything here, and over time the 84% will decrease based on what that particular utility sources their electricity from. And I believe you showed us the graph too, where it shows business as usual, and then there you go, that one. And I believe the purple line is business as usual, but adding our electric Edison sourcing electricity from carbon free sources. And is that true? Is that a good interpretation of this graph, the purple line?
That's correct, Chair Ozerhofsky.
Okay. And going back to table 3-2, I see one of our biggest, our next biggest contributor. I'm going to skip the electricity T&D losses, is employee commute. How do we hope to tackle that? Incentives to purchasing electric vehicles, or what if the employee self identifies that they're taking a bike to work? What's our plan there?
So, Director Lahosky, that's a great question. And, certainly this was done in 2020 prior to, the baseline was 2020, so done prior to the impacts of our telecommuting policy. So there will need to be some updates once that information is, verified and collected. But that certainly is going to be a number one activity that really reduces that is the agency's telecommuting policy. But it could also incorporate, as the plan, I'm looking through here to find what the measures are.
Well, what I'm trying to get at is we have no say in how employees arrive at our facilities. And I don't think we can force our employees to help us out in achieving our goals here.
Right. And so it's the measure TR-1 is to reduce employee commute emissions 15% by 2030. And you're absolutely correct. This is not the measure would not say there's an enforcement component to it, but rather there's an incentive. I think there'll be some natural changes in having electric vehicle charging at some of our employee facilities that will incentivize folks to purchase electric vehicles. Again, there's a telecommuting program and policy. There's riding bikes to work, like you mentioned, or having some other types of programs that we could consider. But the key would be to really understand and work closely with the administration, who's done a fantastic job to date, gauging and understanding our commuting needs and challenges, and then working to develop cost-effective strategies to help accomplish that goal.
Okay, and then going back to electricity T&D losses, which is also kind of reflected on table 5.1 on page 30 as major code EE-1, improve energy efficiency at SCP water facilities and buildings. I would imagine that includes just adding tons of VFDs to wherever we can add them to.
It very well could. I think the key there is first to do the Chair Zerhowski, first to conduct the analysis of the energy using inventory of those facilities and their needs, and then to look at various options and conduct life cycle costing components so that we can identify, again, as to what kind of what Eric was saying, what the marginal price difference is and how that will pan out over the useful life of the device to be more efficient for that facility and for that need.
Have we reached out to operations and got like a rough estimate of I'm just going to use VFDs because that's what we use on our ships. Applicable locations and potentials of VFDs around all of our facilities, including, HVAC units, our air handler units too. Have you reached out to operations and asked them if that's a possibility?
We will, certainly.
Okay, got it. And my last comment is, couldn't find it in time. Going back to page 2 in our board packet, the strategic plan nexus, reliability of delivering not only water, treated water to our ratepayers, but also reliability of services. If that conflicts with our GHG goals, I would imagine that reliability of services supersedes the sustainability plan in emergencies. Is that correct?
I would think that would be correct. In general, I would just note that the co-benefit is that we look for measures that would improve the reliability of the operation. So, okay. If those don't exist, then we're going to continue service. But our goal is to find options that would improve their reliability and resilient operations.
But just looking ahead, let's say we make measures that are acceptable at that particular time, but then we find ourselves in a situation where they conflict with a reliability of service. Is there potential for some sort of penalty if we have a sustainability plan intact and we go against it for a niche out of the blue reason in order to make sure that our reliability of service is constant?
I can speak to this, Matt, real quick. There's no trigger that would have any penalty for countering your sustainability plan in this regard. In fact, much of the state laws related to sustainability and climate change have exemptions to maintain reliability of operations, be them what they may. And there's also specific rules to limit any leakage of operations within the state of California due to the climate change laws. So reliability has always been emphasized by the state through their climate policies.
I haven't had a chance to thoroughly see if that statement is in this plan. The statement that you made, Mr. Feldman, is that written anywhere in this sustainability plan?
I'm not sure if it is. I don't recall that it is. My statement is based on my understanding of state laws and anecdotal interaction with different state agencies.
Okay. Do we see a need of maybe including that in the plan as a footnote or a reference or somewhere in that appendices?
I would defer to Matt and his team for that.
I think that's the, considering Director Ozerhofsky, that is the case and that is an important component. We would be more than happy to find the appropriate space to make sure that is incorporated and document to them.
Directors, any input on that? Are you in? Do you agree?
I agree. I mean, we've got emergency diesel generators that obviously have an impact on our greenhouse gas emission in any given year that we use it. So.
Right. Okay. So, Mr. Dickens, I see a consensus here among committee members to include that kind of a statement in the plan.
Yes, noted.
All right. Any other questions, comments from the committee? All right. I think we can move this forward to the board pending those additional additions. Is the committee in agreement with that?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. All right, Mr. Dickens, looking forward to your presentation during the regular board meeting.
Thank you, Chair Ozerhofsky, members of the committee, and also thank you very much to Eric and Lauren for attending tonight on such short notice. I appreciate your time. Thank you, guys.
Get well, Matt.
Yeah, feel better. But I take it you're going to be presenting another agenda item, so stay put. Thank you, Mr. Feldman and Laura for attending.
Thank you.
All right, let's move on to item number four. Recommend adopting a resolution to enact stage one, reduce from stage two of the water shortage contingency plan and water conservation and water supply shortage ordinance, presented by Mr. Matt Dickens. Mr. Dickens, go ahead.
Matt, you're muted.
Very simple. Mr. Dickens, you are muted. We cannot hear you.
We didn't pass out.
I hope not. Sending a message.
I have been telling him.
Here?
There you are.
Having a little technical problems there. Sorry about that.
You were about to call 911, Mr. Dickens. All right, please go ahead.
Okay, well, thank you, Chair Ozerhofsky and members of the committee. We submitted a resolution for the committee's review for recommendation for more consideration to downgrade the water shortage contingency plan from stage two, which we're currently in, have been since last April 26th, roughly, down to stage one. The state has, as you're well aware, the deluge of precipitation and snowpack have considerably changed the hydrologic drought conditions the state was experiencing in 2021 and 2022, moving us from kind of the thralls of drought to what could be classified as drought recovery. And so based on that, which we're all very thankful for, the safe yield of precipitation and snowpack and to refill our reservoirs and for beneficial use of water. The governor in March issued an executive order following the deluge of, again, rain and precipitation to basically essentially say, We're removing the call for the 15% voluntary conservation call. We are still in the drought emergency. We are also letting the state board either rescind or let expire the stage two measures mandate. But in January, December of last year, the State Water Resource Control Board took action to extend the water waste prohibitions. And then in June of this year, they took action, or maybe it's late May, they took action to extend the non-functional turf ban, the irrigation of non-functional turf with potable water. So with that, we are no longer, the agency is no longer required by emergency resolution to enact stage two measures. Although we are still required, they are still mandated at the state to have water waste prohibitions. Those include irrigating during rain or having irrigation runoff or spraying your washing down sidewalks or washing your car without a hose nozzle, those types of things. And then there's also the ban on non-functional turf, like I mentioned. And so with that, we think that it's appropriate to downgrade our water shortage contingency plan and ordinance activation to stage one. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Dickens. Any questions from the public?
No, just there's not one.
Committee members? President Martin.
Thank you, Matt.
My question is, how can we declare a water shortage when there is none?
So that's a really great question, Director Martin. And technically, based off of our planning through the stage two, one and two of the during the drought, we were neither in a water shortage at that period either. But we were implementing our programs to as required and mandated by the governor's actions and the State Water Resource Control Board's actions, but also because we were, you know, leveraging our banked water supplies. About 45% of our banked water supplies were utilized to augment the 5% State Water Project allocation 2 years in a row. So while we didn't have a technical shortage, we did implement those measures to avoid having a shortage. So the water shortage contingency plan has two primary components. One, to mitigate a potential shortage, and then two, to respond to an actual shortage. So in this case, you know, we're recognizing the state's actions. We're also recognizing that because those stage one measures are still in effect, our plan, our water shortage plan and ordinance has the same measures in stage one. That's the only measures that are in stage one. And that's the common, you know, those common water waste activities, the prohibition of those common water waste activities. And our typical conservation, just normal conservation, is somewhere from 1-3% per year of kind of, you know, forecasted demands. That's our typical kind of normal conservation. So that also falls within the stage one. But it definitely communicates for us, the need to continue to conserve as we replenish those banked water supplies and actually grow those banked water supplies that really provided such huge relief and benefit to the community during this last drought.
Okay, but you know, we still don't address the fact that if we do what you're recommending, we're going to have a number of contradictions to what the water shortage contingency plan actually says. And I will quote from the executive summary, page one, paragraph one, line one. This water shortage contingency plan is a detailed proposal for how the Santa Clara Valley Water Agency intends to act in case of an actual water shortage condition. And this is not an actual water shortage condition. Unless you're going to tell me that we're going to submit our annual water supply indicating that we have a shortage condition right now. And I can't imagine we're going to do that. We can't even find enough places to put the water we can get. On page 9 of the water shortage contingency plan, there's a shortage evaluation process, which on the very top line, when you assess water is sufficient, yes, there's no shortage. And finally, I'll just point out that I would suggest that we go to stage zero because the actions and programs for stage zero are identical to stage one, essentially. You can still do all of what you would do on a stage one if you would declare a stage zero, which is a no shortage condition. And I think if we declare a water shortage when there is none, I think we lose credibility with the public. The public is very aware that we had a very wet winter, that we had 100% allocation from the State Water Project, that we're refilling our water banks, that we're trying to find a place to put all our surplus water this year. And so if we declare a water shortage, if I'm in the public, I'm saying, what the heck is that about? There is no shortage. So I'd just be interested to see what the rest of the committee has to say, but I personally would not support a phase one at this point.
Dr. Martin, I again appreciate the feedback there, and I do not believe we have a stage zero. It is something that we have talked about for the next iteration of the plan. But our stage one, our plan has stages one through stage six, with stage one being up to 10% reduction. And again, considering the extension of the drought emergency from the governor and the extension of the emergency regulations from the State Water Board in January of this year, and most recently, those seem to conform with our stage one of our plan. Just want to make that clarification.
So there's not a stage zero in the plan, by the way.
There, I don't see a stage zero.
Yes, there is.
Oh. So we have a stage zero in the, yes, we have a, our proposed response action strategies has stages one through six. And then we do have a list of a stage zero, which really means no, there is no stage. And that would essentially going to, in this case, downgrading to stage zero would also deactivate the ordinance. There's no stage zero in the ordinance.
And you'll notice in that table that the programs, the outreach, and the restrictions for level zero and level one are identically the same. So nothing stops us from encouraging conservation. And if we need to implement the mandated non-functional turf restrictions, we certainly can do that. But I don't know. I would oppose a stage one when there is no shortage.
No, Cooper.
No. I thought stage one was the bottom and that there's no shortage that's, but if that's still enacting the water shortage contingency plan when you're at stage one, then I agree we should go to stage zero, that we should deactivate the water shortage contingency plan until there is a shortage.
So in this case, stage zero will be just lifting stage two and stage one. Is that right, Mr. Dickens?
I'm going to have to research this one because what the way that we wrote this, once we went into stage one, that was the lowest stage that had enforcement ordinance components associated with it, where no shortage does not have, or stage zero, while it says it in the plan, there is no stage zero in the ordinance, and there's no really stage zero in our on the shortage plan other than normal conservation activity. So we would, if we exit or downgrade from stage two to no shortage, then the ordinance would be inactivated as well.
I'm sorry, can you repeat the last sentence?
If we go from stage two to no shortage, to no shortage, then the ordinance would be inactivated as well.
Meaning we do not have enforcement capabilities, is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And I think your point was this, the state board is still mandating what we have in our stage one, plus this non-functional turf ban. But I don't know if we've taken any, because I will ask, have we taken any enforcement measures while we were in stage two or stage one?
We took no formal enforcement actions during the drought. We communicated with customers and sent out notifications as courtesies, but we did not any enforcement, formal enforcement activities during the drought.
Mr. Dickens, is there a current governing body that's mandating water agencies to state that there's a water shortage condition.
Dr. Ozdrahovsky, not that I'm aware of.
Yeah, I would have to agree with President Martin that there is no shortage condition on record at this time, and there's not a governing body that we are under its jurisdiction that states that we have to be under some sort of a shortage condition. Then, with conditions outlined by President Martin, I think we would have to lift stage two and stage one.
Yeah.
Governor Cooper.
You know, I think I agree. For one thing, I mean, we're going to have a drought again.
Yeah.
We're going to have dry years that are going to come back. If we, in a year when we're getting 100% allocation, our wells are recovering nicely. If we still say we're in a shortage, we look foolish. If we go ahead and disband our what do you call it?
Ordinance.
Enforcement. Now, when we bring it back, it makes it look more forceful.
Yep.
But that's an action that we had to take because of Brian here. So I would say let's just disband the ordinance for now. And then when we have a dry year, come back and put it back in place when we need to.
Because right, otherwise, if we stay at stage one, that becomes a default forever.
Yes.
That's not where you want to be.
Yeah.
When you go to stage one, you don't want some people to take notice.
Yeah.
Mr. Dickens, I haven't checked your reply to my email that I've sent to Ms. King, but same effect, going from stage two to stage one or lifting both stages. Do we have a strategy in place to let the ratepayers know that we're out of the shortage condition, but we would still like for our ratepayers to conserve and work with us on their landscaping and conservation efforts? What's the public outreach strategy when we go from stage to lifting the stage?
This is right along your line of questioning, if I might add.
President Martin, go ahead.
Another quote for you, Matt, page 25, strategy per water shortage level. And under at level zero, a non-shortage level, programs and incentives will continue to be offered to customers at current levels, with the goal to encourage and incentivize customers to create drought sustainable programs in advance of an emergency.
Mr. Dickens, your response?
Yeah, that's essentially, again, I know the plan says a level zero. We just didn't create a stage zero. And so I think that's where I'm getting a little confused there. In our normal operations, we would continue at a non-shortage level. You will continue to develop those programs as we have done in our normal operating protocols. So we do offer all of the programs. They just won't be branded as, drought response or those types of things, rather kind of more general long-term sustainability, conservation, water efficiency, drought ready type of components. So that's the first thing to Director Martin's, President Martin's comment. Director Ozdrahovsky, I think that I would want to communicate with our communications team to determine how we want to best communicate. If we move from stage two to no shortage, how we want to communicate out to the public to, reinforce the need to be to reinforce the conservation ethic as a long-term value of our community, and the putting water to beneficial use and not to waste it, but that and to grow our banked water supplies and to replenish our banked water supplies. But I think that I would like to work with the communications team to determine the most effective way to communicate out to the public that we're no longer in a shortage without creating what could be some consternation in terms of, are we now, do I need to water 7 days a week, 30 minutes per day, those types of things. So we need to promote smart practices, programs, but also noting that we are out of a water shortage.
Well, Matt, if you will, Chair Ozahowski, declaring a shortage when there is none, I think, is more harmful to our message than not.
I would generally concur with that, President Martin.
Okay, so I guess it's the consensus of all committee members that we lift the stage altogether from two to no shortage stage, and if the committee agrees, Mr. Dickens will work with public outreach on a way to properly communicate that with the public, while at the same time, inform the public that, conservation is a way of life.
Yes.
This could probably go on consent calendar with a good explanation.
Committee agrees, consent calendar?
Oh, what did you say, Director?
This could go on the consent calendar with a good explanation, I think.
Yeah, okay with me.
Yeah.
Mr. Dickens, did you get that?
I did. I'll make the changes to the resolution as directed by the committee, and we'll get that prepared for a consent calendar with an explanation.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
All right. And get some rest, Matt. All right. We move on to item 5.1, Santa Clara River Habitat Sustainability. Presented by Ms. Pete Wong.
Before she starts, I kind of just say a couple of things.
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and directors. We came a couple of months ago to present about the Gold Sim Model, which is part of the resiliency initiative that we started a couple of years ago. And today, Ms. Pete Wong will present the next tool in the toolbox that we have been developing, and this is the suitability habitat suitability model that she's going to present to you today about it, which is still a component of the resiliency initiative. And we will continue providing more of those components as we are developing them and bringing them to the committee. With that,
thank you. Today. I will be giving an update on the California Environmental Flows Framework, or CEF. You'll hear me say CEF a lot, and the Habitat Suitability Model, which is a tool that is part of the CEF process. So I will begin with an introduction on what CEF is, the framework, followed by describing the uses of CEF in agency planning. Next, I'll focus on the development of the Habitat Suitability Model, which is one of the planning tools used to support CEF. After I describe how the Habitat Suitability Model is constructed, I will review preliminary observations on existing conditions and end the presentation describing next steps in our process. So the image on the slide is showing how the Santa Clarita Valley watershed is a human natural system that must balance ecosystem, water supply, and regulatory needs in an increasingly complex hydrologic setting. You can see SCD Water has a diverse supply portfolio that consists of many imported supplies, namely the State Water Project, and as well as local supply, and that's primarily groundwater. And because of the variability, the high variability of state water project supplies, this in turn impacts the need for groundwater to supplement our supplies from year to year. And groundwater pumping in turn influences surface water flows through the river. So it is important to understand how environmental flows in the river are influenced by groundwater and recycled water management so that we can support, so that SED can provide support that groundwater pumping is not adversely impacting surface water flows. So the California Environmental Flows Framework is a planning approach adopted by the state of California to develop scientifically defensible environmental flow recommendations that balance human and ecological needs for water. So flow criteria are a range of suitable flow rates and temperatures in different seasons for different habitats and species in different reaches of the river. So why CEF is important is because it will help us understand how groundwater and recycled water management influence environmental flows and assist the agency in making decisions on investment choices. For instance, do we want to cool down wastewater in order to access groundwater, or should we invest in facilities to use recycled water instead of surface water to improve habitats in the river? I want to mention SCD Water is one of the few first agencies stepping up and using CEF, and this will put the agency in a leadership position. This slide is showing how there are several key species and habitats that exist in this ecosystem. And we want to make sure that our planning doesn't adversely impact them. So CEF will help us evaluate how our management actions may influence these key species and habitats. You can see we have riparian woodlands and associated species, like the least-bell sparrow, and that's the bird shown in the upper right image. There's the Santa Ana sucker and the unarmored three-spined stickleback, a few examples. So I will be referring to the unarmored three-spined stickleback as UTS. And these, a lot of this habitat and species, they are supported by groundwater upwelling or surface water flows. There are many planning activities in the agency that the agency is engaged in. And so CEF has many uses in those planning activities. I will be focusing today on the habitat suitability model because, as I mentioned earlier, it is one of the planning tools that we're using to support CEF. It's a model of the river that takes as input flow rates and temperature and outputs a habitat suitability score for different reaches of the river and different species. So the habitat suitability model can help us simulate actions in our planned activities. For example, it can help support our groundwater sustainability plan not just through monitoring water levels, but we can simulate surface water, groundwater interactions. Can also support our urban water management plan and simulate the influence of increased groundwater pumping during extended droughts or periods of water stress. It can support our recycled water program, such as the diversion impacts evaluation, and CEQA assessments. And it can support the agency's watershed stewardship objectives. it's, you know, now that we have a, you know, we have a tool that where we can quantitatively defend our proposed actions, and that will in turn facilitate relationships and leadership with local stakeholders, such as LA County Sanitation Districts or LADWP, DWR, and CDFW. I'm not going to focus too much on this graph, but I did want to put it in because it is the essence of this framework. And this framework is made up of 12 steps divided into three sections. In the first steps, what is done is the identification of natural flow metrics that support ecosystem functions. Excuse me. So these are quantifiable metrics that describe ranges of flows that must be maintained within a stream to support those natural functions of healthy ecosystems. The state protocol is to establish natural flow metrics. The issue of what natural flows are will be contested. Are they prehistoric flows? For our analysis, the hydrograph shown above, where we used 1927 to 2023 to establish a baseline conditions to compare to new management actions. And this graph shows for California streams, there are five functional flows: the fall pulse flow, wet season base flow, wet season peak flows, spring recession flows, and dry season base flows. And with each of these functional flow components has a set of flow characteristics associated with it. So that's that could be the magnitude of the flow, the timing, the duration, the rate of change, and the frequency. So like number of events per year. And each functional flow component also has an ecological function that supports a particular species. So that could be UTS spawning between April and July, maintenance of hydrologic connectivity, or limiting warming or concentration of contaminants. The ranges of flows, natural flow metrics identified for the Santa Clara River alone may not support ecosystem functions. There may be other factors that play a role, such as, like I mentioned earlier, water quality, temperature, and invasive species. So the team, I did identify two factors in addition to the natural flows that impact these functional flows, and that's vegetation encroachment, which narrows channels and concentrates flows, and temperature. As you know, recycled water is hot and groundwater is cold. And this picture is showing some invasive species identified during field work. So there's the castor bean and Aranzo. So if I were just to kind of summarize what I showed graphically earlier.
Well, it's not showing there. I think it's on your.
Is it?
Yeah, it's on your left.
I did a monitor.
Yeah, it looks because it didn't show on both.
Yeah, I think it's the monitor.
Yeah,
the monitor.
That's what I thought.
Mm-hmm. Sorry,
that's okay. All right. So just a summary, you identify functional flow components of the annual hydrograph and then quantify the flow characteristics for each functional flow component. And then you can identify the ecological functions associated with each functional flow. As I mentioned, these alone are not enough to characterize ecological function. We know that there is vegetation encroachment and temperature that also play a role. And so a habitat suitability model is needed to develop these flow ecology relationships between each life history stage of a given species and its preferred depth, velocity, and temperature requirement for optimum growth. So, as I mentioned also earlier, flow in the river is impacted by how much groundwater we pump and how much recycled water is discharged into the river. The habitat suitability model will give us the capability to analyze and defend our use of water in the system to make good policy choices. Different actions will result in different trade-offs, and we're trying to make to find a place where the greatest benefits are preserved, and that is improving supply benefits and protecting the ecosystem in a cost-effective manner. And we think the agency can lead on deciding what is the appropriate balance to continue using water for our supply portfolio while preserving flows in the river. So now I will focus on how the habitat suitability model was developed. We started with a LIDAR survey of the river channel back in July of 2022, and that's from Bouquet Canyon Road to the Ventura County line. Then a hydraulic model of the river was constructed using the LIDAR data. Then that model was run at different flow rates to produce output in the form of velocity and depth at each pixel or cell of the model. So once the once that model was run, the modeling team went out to the field to take measurements of velocity and depth at different points and compared to what the initial hydraulic model simulated. Then parameters in the model were adjusted or calibrated so that simulated results matched observed results. So once the hydraulic model is calibrated, its output in the form of velocity and depth, along with temperature, become input to the habitat suitability model. And this habitat suitability model is essentially made up of curves obtained from field studies as well as literature values that correlate depth, velocity, and temperature to habitat suitability. This here is just an example of two habitat suitability curves for the Santa Ana sucker and the unarmored three-spined stickleback, and that would be for a certain reach of the river. So after you combine depth, velocity, and temperature, you get a habitat suitability curve for each reach of the river. And so what I'm going to do is just go through an example here. For instance, if we choose a flow rate of 10 CFS, or maybe let me back up just a bit. So the horizontal axis shows the flow rate, and the vertical axis is the colored curves are for different temperatures. So we have different increments of temperatures, and then the output, which is on the vertical axis, is the habitat suitability. Here we are using the metric weighted usable area, so the usable area within each reach that is suitable for habitat. So if I were to take, you know, choose a 10 CFS flow, you can see for the UTS that you have suitable habitat at temperatures equal or less than 22 degrees Celsius. Anything warmer than that provides no suitable habitat for UTS. And using that same flow rate, if you look at the Santa Ana sucker, there is unsuitable habitats regardless of what the temperature is. So what this is illustrating is that one reach of the river may be suitable for one species, but not for another. And so now, so based on, you know, that preliminary work, we did run a scenario on existing conditions using 17 years of data. And I want to show what our preliminary observations, and starting from, you know, I'm going to move from the east to the west basin. So from Saugus Water Reclamation Plant to McBean, initial results are showing that it is thermally unsuitable for UTS every summer and fall. The flow is too low for Santa Ana sucker year-round. It does support riparian habitat, and it's unaffected by groundwater fluctuations. And then we have this McBean dry gap, which supports nothing. It's just dry. And then from San Francisco Canyon to Valencia Water Reclamation Plant, it's suitable for UTS when flow exceeds 1 CFS, but temperature constrained most summers. It's unsuitable for Santa Ana sucker due to low flows. It's suitable for riparian habitat, and UTS habitat expands and contracts in response to groundwater depth. These results are consistent with the GSP. This area is of tremendous importance for GDEs. The habitat suitability model coupled with the groundwater model provides us with a tool to illustrate how our monitoring program and management plan will protect the area. We can use the model to show to regulatory agencies that our operating plan or installation of new wells will not harm sensitive species. We can also use it for CEQA compliance. This is additional analysis that has not been done before and can provide answers that regulatory agencies are looking for. So next, from Valencia Water Reclamation Plant to Castaic Creek, it's thermally unsuitable or constrained for UTS every summer and fall. It is suitable for Santa Ana sucker. It's highly suitable for riparian habitat, and it's been observed that there is persistently high groundwater since the 1940s near Valencia. There is some habitat sensitivity to groundwater near Castaic. And then this last characteristic reach from Castaic Creek to Pyru, the temperature is unsuitable or limited for UTS every summer and fall. It's suitable for Santa Ana sucker. It's suitable for riparian habitat, and there is some sensitivity to groundwater level, but other factors play a stronger role, and these other factors are flow and temperature. So I wanted to add one additional slide to illustrate how our different, you know, how our suite of models that are being developed or further developed under this initiative will communicate with each other. So how do we do this integrated analysis? And so what I'm showing here is a hypothetical groundwater management scenario. That's maybe something new, a bit different than what's in the GSP, but designed to further improve water supply benefits. So we want to evaluate it to make sure we're not causing any adverse impacts to sensitive species. So what we would do is run it through the groundwater model, and the groundwater model would output an outflow or flow rate to the river, which becomes an input to the habitat suitability model. So along with temperature, we can now get a habitat suitability curve. And, you know, this would be run over a sequence of hydrologies. And then we can summarize the results into an exceedance curve. And here, again, just an example, not real data. The green line is showing what would be an existing conditions exceedance curve. And the blue is the curve when we run our hypothetical groundwater management scenario. So going back to the left side of this slide, we would also use this groundwater management scenario as an input to our water resources integration model, which is the Goldsmith model. And that can give us an output, for instance, on our water supply reliability. And so, again, green would be existing conditions, blue with a new groundwater scenario. And so now we have performance indicators that we can compare. We can say, what is the, based on agency objectives, what is the percent of time we are meeting a certain goal, a certain probability of suitable habitat or, reliable water supply. And so we can compare trade-offs. This here is showing just two metrics, but as we progress, we're going to layer on more metrics such as groundwater levels or groundwater storage, impact to ratepayers by implementing these new strategies, or what is the impact to downstream water users. So there's just, and that's something we will bring to you to, make sure we are considering all these metrics in our analysis. So this is the last slide, and basically the next steps in this work are to develop criteria and objectives for the agency to drive management of the watershed and water resources. This is needed to finalize the SEF work. And then we want to start evaluating new groundwater and recycled water management actions that address ecological needs and improve water supply reliability. And so we want to as we start these next steps, we want to approach you and the board for policy guidance based on this work. As I mentioned earlier, as an example, do we want to invest in facilities to cool down wastewater so we can access groundwater? Or should we invest in facilities to use recycled water instead of surface water to improve habitat in the river? And of course, with each one of these associated is a cost that we will present to you. I think this work shows we've achieved a significant milestone with the budget you authorized, for us to have a consultant to work on this process. The state is doing SEF work, and I think SCV embracing this work illustrates leadership. I think this will really position us to, instead of being reactive or losing control over our destiny, I think it will position us to actually really drive, our destiny. I'm looking forward to further engaging with everyone in the future on how to operate our basin. Thank you.
Comments from the public in attendance? None. Any virtual attendees? No committees, questions, comments?
Absolutely amazing. I knew very little about the Santa Ana sucker, and it's amazing that the UTS has been able to survive this long in this river. They're very sensitive, way more sensitive to the temperature than I thought they were. This is great data. This in the future can really help us.
Mr. Martin?
Thank you for your presentation. Very impressive. Is the CEFF a state mandated effort that we have to do?
It's not. It's it was funded by the State Water Board and developed by a consortium of universities, agencies, such as the Nature Conservancy or the Southern California Coastal Water Research Program, I think. You know, UC Davis and UC Berkeley. So the idea is to develop a consistent and standardized methodology that can be used across the state. So even CDFW was part of this. So it will be, you know, it really shows we are embracing it and we're proactive. And
how does this integrate with the groundwater sustainability agency and the plan going forward?
So it will. I mean, I see it as complementary to our GST monitoring, and I think it further supports, you know, we have metrics now on the, you know, aquatic habitat that, so it's not just through monitoring of groundwater levels. We have, you know, we have data to show that our GSP is not impacting the environmental flows.
Yeah, that's great.
Chair of the House, President Martin, just to add to what Nigel mentioned, when we are updating our next groundwater sustainability plan, when we are doing an update in 5 years, as they are asking us to do, a lot of this information is going to help us in fine-tuning the relationship between the groundwater and the surface water in our basin. We have a lot of good findings, you know, as example, the impact of temperature. That's a significant finding from the model that we found. There will be a significant, you know, there is an impact from the encroached vegetation. So that will be something that need to be considered in the next update of the GSP. So as Najwa mentioned, this work is going to be complementary to the GSP, and it will provide a lot of data that's not available for us when we develop the groundwater management plan. Initially, so this is going to be helpful for us when we are updating the plan.
Will this influence trigger levels and then for the groundwater dependent ecosystem evaluation?
It will in some time that it will. The difference between the GSP, it's the thresholds and the levels are specific numbers, data points. While the surface or the habitat model, and Nigel, correct me if I'm wrong, is giving us a range of information. So if we are looking into a new management practices for our groundwater, you know, a new pumping scenario that we want to test, it would be very helpful to test it with the integrated model rather than only the groundwater model. Because now we are doing it with those regard to those thresholds and numbers, but we're not really checking the impact of that on the suitability of the reaches of the river for these species that's protected. So hopefully this will help into moving us into the next level of looking into things from an integrated point of view rather than just taking the groundwater level and the groundwater thresholds that's identified in the GSP.
Is there a possibility this, as you develop this information, it could free up more water coming from the treatment plants for recycled use as opposed to dedicating so much to the groundwater-dependent ecosystem?
You know, I just want to add something. You've seen how variable the flows are, right? That functional flow graph shows high variability throughout seasons and years. And so the exceedance curves that I showed for habitat suitability here, this is not part of the methodology in CEF. That's something I worked on with the consulting team because I recognized early on we needed comparable performance indicators. But in talking, you know, just one initial conversation with actually Square, you know, they were also saying they found it difficult, you know, because of this highly dynamic nature of the system, right? High, you know, variability in hydrology. And, you know, it's always like habitat is waxing and waning all the time. It's, you know, expanding and contracting. You know, I had suggested a probabilistic approach, some exceedance levels, and they seemed very, I mean, that's like a year ago, they seemed very interested in that method. So I think, you know, we might be, you know, as an agency with our consultants, developing methodology to help with CEPH, especially for Southern California, because CEPH was developed for Northern California watersheds that are really controlled by dam releases. So you have more control over flow rates. And then just one other thing, you know, with the GSP monitoring, we're looking, you know, we were monitoring the riparian habitat, and now we have something to put metrics on aquatic habitat as well, on it, you know, so that's why, you know, it is complementary. And basically, yeah, I think one other thing is that because now we can show that, you know, we have this dynamism in our system. Maybe if we exceeded a threshold for a short period of time, that's, you know, in our GSP, we can show that it's not adversely impacting the habitat because it is resilient. So now we have a way to show that. So it's not, you know, we don't have to, it's not like a binary, you know, trigger or no trigger, and you're so constrained by how you can operate your basin. It gives us that flexibility.
Just to piggyback on President Martin's question, did California State Lands Commission have any requirements for CFFF or not really?
Sorry?
California State Lands Commission, are they part of this?
I don't think, I'm not sure. But I mean, we are not, there is no regulatory requirements.
All right. And then I'm curious about the temperature gradient downstream of discharge. Do we have a plot of, you know, water's coming out at 30 degrees Celsius, and how far down the line does it come into a temperature equilibrium with the environment? How far? Let's say at the highest discharge rate.
I don't have that. I mean, we know right downstream of the treatment plants, the temperature is high. You know, actually, let me see if I have that. Might not be here.
Just curious, at the, let's see, the RD point, RE point.
Yeah, it's funny, I was looking at a slide just earlier, but I can't remember which slide that shows over distance.
Yeah, just how far does it take to come into a temperature equilibrium? I'm just curious.
And I think that there are some studies that are underway. The regional board mandated that the Santa district meet certain temperature discharge requirements. And there's a joint study that's being undertaken actually by the same consultant who helped put some of the CEPH material together, this habitat law. So I think it's, I prefer to say that that's a work in progress.
Okay, understood. And then going back to let's see, your slide number, the habitat suitability model, the two graphs that you had, I think it's page 12 on the PDF, that one right there. So the weighted usable area, is that from literature?
It is from literature and field studies, yeah. You want to know more about it?
No.
Okay.
Just going to the list. Okay.
Chair Wazowski, I think just to add to Director Mark's mention, currently, I think Nigel, you are part of the temperature study that the SAN district is leading. And I think that would be a really good question that we can ask to them, just to know how the temperature gradient different per distance from the release, as well also as the seasonality, because at sometimes and during drought and during wet right. season, there will be a lot of discussions about that. But that's a really good question that we'll bring back to that team that was studying the temperature.
And one more question, as far as cooling the water prior to discharge / release, are we exploring like cooling towers, or what's the technology currently available?
I think, yeah, there is like actual mechanical cooling being considered. I am part of the technical advisory committee for that temperature study with LA County Sanitation District. But we have a meeting coming up in a few weeks, so we'll know what they've been talking about. But I think, you know, the initial work has been really focused on understanding the temperature impacts to species. So it's very more sciencey right now. And I think one thing they're doing now is just filling in data gaps. So they are proposing to add more instrumentation along the river to measure temperature, to keep track of that. So, but yeah, I know there's mechanical cooling is one of them, one option. And there are other options where you might maybe recharge the groundwater basin so that, you know, there are certain areas in the basin that may, are conducive to recharge. So that could be a cooling impact.
Okay. So,
yeah,
not an immediate concern.
Yeah.
Just FYI, all the majority of pharmaceutical plants have very effective cooling towers. That technology exists. It's very widespread. Okay, interesting.
Mr. Chair, I have seen in some places around the country where they have cooling of wastewater. I came from a wastewater agency. From Minnesota, and in some places, our discharge, we needed to cool it down because of some species on the river. And so, in some cases, we have been using cooling towers for that. And that's in some places it's a practice that's doing. In other places that I worked for in New Mexico, we used deep groundwater released deep groundwater in small amounts into the river and from augmentation wells, specific augmentation wells that we pump that water, put it in the river, let it mix with the discharge from the river, and that will create the equilibrium that's needed. And so there is, as Nigro mentioned, there is a lot of options that we didn't need to start thinking about maybe when we have all this information available for us.
Okay. So what's the next step after showing this study? You mentioned that you would like feedback from directors on.
So you know we see right we part of the set is actually fixing defining what the agency's ecological and management, so water management objectives are. What we've done with the CEF is instead of wait for these objectives, we actually did it backward where we said, let's run a range of flow rates, like from 0 CFS to 100 CFS, and then a range of realistic temperatures, maybe 20 to 30 degrees Celsius. So now we have a library of habitat suitability for different flow rates and temperatures, which kind of is nice because we can use them as bookends. To test, these different management scenarios. For instance, if we want to do something with recycled water, if we want to decrease recycled water releases to the river, it could be beneficial from a temperature stance and maybe not from a flow rate, perspective. But so to define these objectives, though, we need to start exploring these, new management actions, like new groundwater management actions, because we want to look at we want to look at the integrated impact of our actions on different, I guess you can say, water sectors. So water supply reliability, maybe, you know, groundwater levels, rates, and so on. So what we've done now is we started a regular work group to start exploring these management actions. You know, we have now prepared the have we have a tool ready. We have two tools ready. Well, three: the groundwater model, the Goldstone model, and the habitat suitability model. But we haven't started testing new groundwater management actions or other management scenarios. But we, you know, we need that so we can come back to you and start getting feedback. So I'll just to make it even more concrete. You know, if we wanted to recharge water in the alluvial aquifer in our basin, one thing, you know, we are exploring is, well, we would like to explore or evaluate is if we recharged in the eastern portion of our basin, the alluvial aquifer, could this allow us to pump more groundwater in the dry season when, you know, it becomes... You can see, you know, it's more groundwater influence on river flows is more critical. So, you know, we would test, right, get the metrics and come back to you and say, we think this is a feasible option. And that's the price tag. And these are the benefits and, you know, drawbacks and so on. Another example would be, do we want to, recharge the Saugus or maybe we want to back off pumping from certain wells, maybe along the river, you know, where we know there's sensitivity to the river flows and we want to pump more from other wells. So, you know, some of it is like fine tuning our existing operations. Others are completely new projects. Another one could be that we want to invest in a new groundwater banking program outside our basin. So now we have something where we can compare all these options and maybe we want to combine a few together and, you know, look at them as packages. And that's where, you know, we would want feedback.
Very dynamic process.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to add to what Nadia mentioned. Probably there will be different stages where the board is going to be engaged in this process. Right now, as Najwa mentioned, we are working with an internal and our consultants work group to look into the goals and objectives, and we will present that for the agency to, for the board to make sure that that fits well with your strategic plan goals and the agency goals and everything. And these are going to be kind of statements, higher level statements like, we wanted to be a good stewards of the ecological system, but at the same time, we would like to maintain our ability to access gravel, something at that level.
Okay.
So that discussion is going to happen at that level. Determining those, then the next step will be digging into those specific management strategies that Nadia was talking about. Do we want to invest into recharge? Do we want to invest into recharge of the alluvial aquifer? And those different management strategies, we're going to run them through this integrated analysis. The results are going to come back to you to look into this and give us guidance on which management strategies that will fit with the direction of the agency.
Understood.
Very good.
Any other comments? Very
interesting.
Questions from directors? Okay. Thank you. Thank you for the presentation.
Thank you.
All right, move on to item 5.2, staff activities, presented by Mr. Alessandro.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, directors. I have a couple of items that I would like to report on. I think I'm taking from the duty from Sarah today. I'm going to give a water supply update. I don't have graphs and pictures, so unfortunately, it's going to be just me talking. So January through May of this year, our demand has been met by 35% of our local groundwater pumping and 65% from imported supplies. As we mentioned in a couple of updates, I think a couple of months ago, we started requesting Article 21 delivery And so far we have received about 1,200 acre feet from the Article 21, and that's that will be confirmed later on from the DWR. Our demand has been lower than 2022 by 30%. So this is kind of clearly because of the cooler weather, wet season that extended until April. So our water demand has been lower by 30% from last year. We are in agreements with our banking partners to maximize our banking for this year. We are planning to bank 20,000 acre feet to Rosedale and about 5,000 acre feet in semi-tropic. So that plan is in place, the agreement's in place, and we are implementing that right now. We are getting draft agreement for an exchange with Rosedale. We are in the process of reviewing that right now, that the final details of the agreement is not yet there, but we are hoping to exchange about 20,000 acre feet with them from our 100% location for this year. We are also coordinating with United to deliver Article 21 as available for the last 2 weeks of June. As we mentioned in previous presentations, United have been using the local flows that came as a result of all this rain that has been stored in Castaic, and they have been releasing all of that over the last probably 3 months. That ended end of May. And so now United, they would like to continue using Article 21. And as we came before the board, we have an agreement now in place with United to do something like this. And so we are going to start implementing our agreement that approved by the board, I think, in April of this year, so that we can release Article 21 in Castaic Creek. That will benefit us by recharging groundwater and benefiting them for the same purposes. Right now, we are working in the agreements and kind of implementing the agreement that's in place. And we're working with them in the delivery for the next 2 weeks. The total amount that they are planning to use from Article 21 or request for Article 21 is 2,600 acre feet. So that will be released in the next the last 2 weeks of
that for both agencies.
Yes, for both agencies. That's the first water supply update. The next article or the next item in my presentation today or my report is we started a development relationship with Westside Water Agency. We had in the past relationship with them, and we sold them some water when we had higher locations. We sold them the water. We didn't have an exchange, but this time we started a collaboration, and Sarah actually had a meeting with the agency, and looking into potential opportunities for water exchange. They are interested in that. Myself and Mr. Vassilopoulos, we had a meeting with other group in the agency where they are looking for collaboration opportunities for Devil's Den, because it's very neighboring to some of their members, and so they were interested in accessing our water quality data, the groundwater quality data, as part of what they collect. A lot of data they collect samples from wells for all their members. And they were interested in knowing more about the groundwater, just to have a bigger regional picture about the groundwater quality. And also they asking us for access to some of our wells for sampling. If they can do the sampling, we can benefit, get the information in addition to what they are getting the information that they needed. Our staff is working to develop the new groundwater sampling agreement. We have a surface water sampling agreement with them that's in place. And so we are trying to build on that surface water sampling agreement which give them access to our property to do sampling whenever there is flow in the property. And so now we're looking into groundwater sampling agreements. We also, they have a significant experience in developing solar systems in their properties. And so they provided us with consultants that work for them to help us into explore opportunities for us for Devil's Den. And so we got the information from their consultants, and we are asking the consultants to provide some proposals for us now. Our staff are working with them. They were really curious to invite us to visit their facilities, and also they wanted to visit Devil's Den when it's not 100 degrees out there. So probably we're going to do it in October or November of this year. So my next item for my report today is the GSA board meeting that happened in June 5th. The GSA board approved the budget for 2023-2024. The board also directed staff to revise proposed well permitting review procedures for the GSA, which is required by the governor's executive order. There will be a special board meeting to finalize the process that's scheduled for July 27th, this next July. My last item today is myself and Mr. Vergoots attended a Sigma implementation workshop in Sacramento last week. And this is organized by ACWA as well as the Groundwater Resources Association. There was a significant presence from the DWR just providing feedback about the processes of Sigma and the approvals processes for the groundwater sustainability plans. We attended a couple of presentations from the DWR. I'm just summarizing some of what we heard from the DWR staff presenting in that. I'm not sure if I'm going to hold them for that because things change and keeps changing. But one of the things that I identified in the presentation from a keynote speaker from the DWR is about that all the groundwater sustainability plans will be reviewed by January of 2024. So hopefully we'll get ours reviewed and approved hopefully by next January. But that's the plan for the DWR right now. Another significant information that was shared at that time that DWR recognized that more guidance on interconnected surface water and groundwater is needed, especially on determination of depletion. And the term depletion became a very important term for what the meaning of depletion and how you are going to have a procedure on how to calculate depletion and how to determine if your activities are really depleting the surface water features. And so they are planning to use a phased process with public review and public engagement, and hopefully we'll be part of that because that will be helpful for us to understand what the guidance is going to provide to us. This is probably about a year process that they are starting this summer. So hopefully by the summer of 2024, we'll have a guidance on determining the interconnection between surface water and groundwater as well, and how that should be represented in our updated GSB for the next round. They are also recognized that most of the groundwater sustainability plans that were developed not using extreme climate change models. And so this is the, and then they understand why, because it's people have been using historic data as replicated to happen in the future. And so, but it seems like they are shifting their way of the way of thinking about it. They might press agencies to use more extreme climate change factors moving forward. They didn't give us more idea about how that will look like and how that will, you know, what that means. And definitely this, if they do that, that will affect all the planning all statewide. And so We're just waiting to get more information about what kind of extreme climate modeling that they're going to provide to us.
So no specific verbiage, nothing like that?
Nothing yet.
Okay.
The last thing I wanted to talk about, that what we got in that meeting, we had a chance to sit with our counterparts from the different agencies who developed the GSAs, the different GSAs and different GSP developers. And a couple of issues that were discussed is the interconnection between surface water, groundwater, and the depletion is one of the biggest difficulties that faced by many of the groundwater sustainability plans. And technical and policy considerations were discussed in that roundtable of experts. There was common themes that there is significant data gaps in terms of groundwater elevation below some of these dry reaches of the river. We are not the only ones who are complaining about that. It seems like that theme for so many of the agencies around the state. Stream gauges, actual habitat present, whether they are present or not, and that's a big question also they're asking. And also they are the biggest question, I think, at the end of the day, that we didn't have any answer for it from whether the DWR or someone else, is that what's the role of drought versus groundwater pumping in stream flow, and how you can distinguish between the impact of groundwater pumping and the drought, the natural drought and the stream flow, and how you can differentiate between those, which one is having a bigger impact at what time of the year. And so there was a lot of discussion about that. Again, I think the nicest thing is to see that other GSAs are wrestling with the similar issues that we are wrestling with here in our GSA. The last topic that we talked about in some of these roundtable was the well permitting and the responsibility that's put on the GSAs by the executive order from the governor on well permitting and how that working. And you can see there is a variety of responses from the different GSAs, how they are handling that. We have some ideas, and hopefully that will bring some of these ideas when we meet with the GSA in a couple of weeks. With that, that's the end of my report. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Hassan. Any questions from the public? Is there anyone from the public?
There was.
Right, directors, comments, questions?
Good report. Thank you.
Thank you for the detailed report. All right, let's move on to committee plan calendar.
Mr. Chair, as we are looking at the calendar, probably there will be some change for July. It seems like July we have a very very full calendar so far, but working with some staff, I can assure you that there will be some of these items are going to be moved. I understand that. I know that Mr. Tua is coming back again for a presentation about the use of Gold SIM in evaluation of a scenario that we're going to present to you. But some of the other issues are still, I need to work with Mr. Cole when he's back to finalize the agenda for July. One of the things that we want to bring in front of you in July also is the grants, and just kind of a how we have been doing with the grants and how much money we got, just kind of report about the grants and the grants activities. That's going to be done by Ms. Fowler when she's back also. And so probably we'll have two presentations. I'm very sure that's the plan so far. But things might change. I will take any questions.
Before questions, questions from the public in attendance? Having no public virtually, directors, questions, comments? Well, thank you for modifying the committee planning calendar by just stating the next meetings and not dating back. That definitely saves on
paper.
And also for being very detailed too. I like that a lot too. I think all the directors appreciate that. All right, with no further questions and comments, we move to item number 7, adjournment. Adjournment meeting. Thank you everyone for joining us today.